This music by Maurice Ravel seems to evoke the tick-tock of a clock. And it's a wonderful metaphor for Ravel himself and his approach to composing. We're told Ravel was introduced to Igor Stravinsky through the Ballet Russe, and they went on to collaborate on a version of Mussorgsky's Revanchina. Apparently, Stravinsky was impressed with Ravel and described him as a Swiss watchmaker. Maurice is a perfectionist in his compositional process, paying scrupulous attention to detail, said Stravinsky. That from T. Breitenfeld's study, Maurice Ravel, the pathography. If Stravinsky compared Ravel to a watchmaker, the musical metaphor of the clock may make us smile as we hear the introduction to L'Heure Espagnole, literally the Spanish hour, or idiomatically the Spanish time, or how they keep time in Spain. James Keller tells us in his notes for the San Francisco Symphony. The story is set in the 18th century. We're in a workshop of Torquemada, a Spanish clockmaker, who is seated in front of his shop when Ramiro, a mule driver in the government employ, enters to have his watch repaired. While Torquemada is working on the watch, Concepcion, his wife, comes in to remind him that he has forgotten his regular weekly task, that of regulating the municipal clocks. He leaves in haste, asking Ramiro to wait for his watch until he returns. And the story continues to unfold with many lovers and many clocks. We'll have a rare chance to hear L'Heure Espagnole in a double bill with the Bretel Lieder, the cabaret songs by Arnold Schoenberg, this weekend at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton under the musical direction of William Hobbs, a graduate of the Eastman School, who works at many of the world's major opera houses, the Salzburg Festival, San Francisco, Chicago Lyric, Seattle Opera, and Washington Opera among them. Hobbs has served on the faculty of the Aspen Opera Theater Center of the Aspen Music Festival, and in February 2015, he made his professional conducting debut at the Tri-Cities Opera with Rossini's L'Italiana in Algeri. WVIA's Peter Wynn paid a visit to Tri-Cities in Binghamton to talk with William Hobbs about this production.
This is an interesting double bill that you're doing. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I will say that the double bill was Susan Ashbaker's idea, not mine, and that when she first approached me and invited me to participate in the production, I was a little bit surprised, maybe a little bit skeptical about how well the two pieces would fit together, since the cabaret songs are not conceived as a unit necessarily and are not really a dramatic work. And then as I thought about it, I realized that the pairing is actually brilliant, and especially the way that they have put the show together, James Mitchell developed a through line, and the story that is told during the cabaret section is about Marilyn Monroe's career, and the singer goes back and forth from quoting Marilyn Monroe, actual things that she had said and written, to performing the songs, and it provides an exceptionally interesting view both of Marilyn Monroe as a human being and the face of the cabaret world in the early parts of the century, and a lot of the ambiguity about gender roles and expectations and I guess the kind of possibilities for, shall we say, romantic involvement that seem to have been available in certain circles earlier in the century. And in that respect, it's a fantastic pairing with the Ravel, which is ultimately about the same thing.
Now, are you going to use one or two voices in the Bretel Lieder?
It's just one. It's just one singer, Stacey Geyer, who is singing all the songs and acting Marilyn Monroe between the songs. She does have a cohort of four or five guys who help her out in various ways, but she's really carrying the whole show by herself. Mary Beth Nelson is the lead role. She's the woman in the L'Heure Espagnole, in the Ravel piece, and it's a little bit perhaps on the misleading side to make it seem like she is the main character, because it's quite an ensemble piece. And all five characters, they're pretty much equally fleshed out, and they're all equally important to telling the story. It's just that only one of them is female. So it's one woman and four men. Mm-hmm. And since the ultimate exploration, at least the way that I am seeing this, I didn't develop it by any means, but what I'm seeing is that it's a real exploration of both the differing roles and expectations of women versus men now, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, how much they may have changed or may not have changed, and the options that were available to women 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and now, so that it ends up being very female-centered. But the piece, the Ravel piece per se, Mary Beth's role, Concepcion, is not, like I said, she's not specifically the lead character. It's just she is the sort of catalyst for everything that happens.
Well, one of the things I find interesting is that while the music between Ravel and Schoenberg are very, very different, and yet both of them are making a point of setting the words in a coherent, you know, linguistic sort of way.
Mm-hmm. That is very interesting. I would say that it's exceptionally interesting in the case of the, well, I guess each of them slightly differently. In the Ravel, L'Heure Espagnole is one of a rather small number of pieces where it is so clearly driven by the text, and that it's a really fascinating 45-minute, if you will, opportunity to hear the different ways that a genius like Ravel can set text so that it's always clear, but never the same quite around every little corner, every page turn. There's always something different. And the sonorities that he manages to invent between the accompaniment and the voices are extraordinary. And the Schoenberg is, he's not really known for that, you know. And it's funny that these cabaret songs, which were written very, very early in his career before he became the Arnold Schoenberg that everybody learns about and is scared of, that it's they're a much more relaxed union of the text and the music. And you really have the impression that it was just a bunch of friends writing these songs together.
Now, the Ravel has one of the biggest and most varied orchestras. What are you doing in your little reduction here?
Well, because of space limitations, we have we only have three players. So we have piano, harp, and percussion. So we are able to capture quite a bit of the variety, the sonic variety of the original through the percussion, because he's playing something like 15 instruments. And the harp is such a huge part of the Ravel sound, just like the French orchestral sound of that period anyway, that there will be lots of moments where the harp will just add that little extra bit of, well, that je ne sais quoi, if you will, that will really make it quite special. And the piano covers the rest. So it's not quite as sumptuous as the original, but with the elements that we have, it works extremely well.
Who did the orchestral reduction? I know you're an arranger. Did you do this yourself?
To a point. I mean, what we did was we purchased the orchestra parts for the harp and all of the percussion. And knowing that we only had one percussionist available, I think it's written for, it's unclear in the score how many percussionists are required for the original, but somewhere between two and five. And so I took the percussion parts and I made a little roadmap for the player saying, you start here, now move to timpani, now move to xylophone, now move to bass drum, now move back to timpani, now move to this and that, just in order to ensure the greatest number of cues. And the harp part, it's originally written for two harps, so I had to make choices based on when they were playing at the same time, which one would give more color. And then it's just a question of making sure that the piano doesn't play the harp cue at the same time. So in it, to an extent, I would say that I am responsible for the arrangement, but it's not actually an arrangement. It's more of a distillation, if you will.
Now, when you talk about the piano, I understand that's you.
It originally was going to be, I'm playing the Schoenberg, but the Ravel, John Elam will play, and then I'll conduct. I think the piece is a little bit too complicated. It's just it's a little bit too much to ask for the two players to come in, learn the entire piece with the three rehearsals that we have, to be able to follow the singers no matter what they do. And since I've been here for the whole rehearsal period, it will be just easier if I can keep them all in line.
Now, will you have any of the additional instruments in Bretolita? What about a piccolo?
Well, the original is scored for piano, trumpet, piccolo, and snare drum. And of those four instruments, we definitely have the piano, and we also have the snare drum. So we have to cover the trumpet and the piccolo lines on the piano. But it actually works out, in my opinion, I think it actually works better in terms of what the show is doing, because the original scoring really emphasizes the noisiness of the poem. The guy walking around in the street with his trumpet player and his piccolo player and a percussionist, they're just making a lot of noise to annoy everyone. And the way that Stacy is playing the song is a little bit more intimate, and it doesn't quite emphasize the obnoxious aspects of the song. So I feel like it works better anyway.
Now, you've made something of a specialty in your career of coaching and working with young singers. Is that one of the things that attracted you to do this project?
Yes, I love it. And not to blow my own horn, but working with young singers is not something that everybody is equally good at. And some people really do their best work with seasoned professionals, and some people do their very best work with beginners or children, you know. And I've always felt that the connection that one gets with a young singer, there's nothing like it. It's irreplaceable. As I find that with more experienced professionals, the rehearsal process tends to be about just figuring out where they have to go when and, you know, what the basic emotional content of a particular scene is, but that they have so much more experience with every aspect of performing opera that one could say that they tend to be very conservative in rehearsal about their emotional investment or their musical investment. And young singers are always, as I would say, they're always ready to play. And I find that the satisfaction that I get out of being part of a process where a young singer not only gets better, but really becomes a very open and more fearless performer, it's one of the things that I love the most about what I do.
Now, you did The Italian Girl in Algiers here 2 years ago. That must have been a very, very different experience for you with a full orchestra and so on.
It definitely was, and it was much less intimate, but on the other hand, it was grander. And the production that Dottie Danner brought to Binghamton was such a hoot, and it was great to be part of that. I will say that having it be in the Forum rather than in the Opera Center really impacted what we were able to do in terms of nuance, and which is funny because it's Rossini, so you don't necessarily think of Rossini as being terribly nuanced anyway. But it's a slightly different experience. Is it one of the things that I think is great about opera is that sometimes it can be very grand, and then sometimes it can be very intimate, and that it is possible for opera to work in like an infinite number of environments and situations, and that it's possible for the audience to connect with like Aida, for example, or Tosca, where it's everything is enormous, or for an evening like this one where the singers could be 10 feet away from you. And I can't say that I prefer one over the other. Obviously, the full orchestra and the huge production with the big sets and the big costumes and the big singing and the big personality is great. It's really great. but also the intimacy and knowing that the connection on stage with the singers is really genuine, and you can really see them as performers and as people just from being so close to them. That's also a little bit of a drug, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a fantastic experience.
Now, what languages will these two be in? Well, we have French for L'Espagnol and German for the Bretelita. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I lived in France for 5 years, so my French is really very good. And it was, I guess, probably one of the main reasons that Susan invited me to participate in this project was that my spoken French is so good, so that I am able to communicate some nuances in the text that the singers may have missed, and that's great. But ideally, a French-speaking audience member would be able to understand the majority of what they're saying and would also leave with the impression that they really understood the text and they really understood the dramatic beats and the little digs, the little jokes here and there that are embedded in the text, which is not to say that a non-French-speaking person would not get it. I mean, we have the titles, and the production, what James has done, James Mitchell, is really fantastic. And it tells the story so clearly. And the music and the text, everything, it just fits together so beautifully.
Now, of course, the Arnold Schoenberg of the Bretelieder is a very different composer from the guy who wrote any number of operas we can think of, Moses und Aaron, for example.
Yes, Moses und Aaron will never be performed at Tri-Cities Opera, I'm pretty sure. But I understand that seeing Arnold Schoenberg on a marquee can be a deterrent to a lot of audience members who have heard Moses und Aaron or Piero Lunaire or these other pieces that are very difficult to listen to. And I think that for me, it's a little bit ironic, but actually extremely interesting that Schoenberg, who was one of the pioneers of what we consider 20th century contemporary music, was also one of the pioneers in the attitude that developed over the course of the 20th century that art music was not meant to be accessible to, quote-unquote, the common man. And that this kind of elitist attitude toward music, as the music itself became less and less accessible, I think we're seeing the results today, that a lot of audience members are maybe a little bit afraid to go to a classical concert because they think that they won't get it, or that it'll be boring, or that it'll be ugly. And it's funny that these cabaret songs, if you didn't know that they were written by the same man who wrote Moses und Aaron and Piero Lunaire, you would never think that they were the same person, because they are funny, they're very much in the style of cabaret songs. So, I mean, some of them could pass for, maybe this is a little bit extreme, but some of them could pass for standards, you know, that you could hear the vast majority of those songs in a piano bar and not think twice about it, except that they were in German. So you'd be you could hear Marlene Dietrich singing them. I mean, they could be written by Cole Porter. And it's funny that he, like 10 years later, was writing music that most people just cannot get into, and that he finished his career again returning to tonal music much, much later in life. But I do hope that the audience members will come in and check these songs out. And I mean, the Ravel, of course, is wonderful. It's such beautiful music, and it's impossible, in my opinion, not to love it. And the Schoenberg, I think, will be a big surprise for a lot of audience members. So I hope that people will come and give it a chance.
William Hobbs, music director and conductor for the pairing of L'Espagnol by Maurice Ravel and the Bretelieder, the cabaret songs by Arnold Schoenberg, at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton at the Opera Center, 315 Clinton Street, this Friday, February 24th at 7:30 in the evening, and again Sunday, February 26th, a matinee at 3. For more information on the web, tricitiesopera.com, tricitiesopera.com, Leur Espagnol and Brettel Lieder by Schoenberg at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton, and that's at the Opera Center, 315 Clinton Street, Friday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m., and again Sunday, February 26th at 3 in the afternoon. For more information on the web, tricitiesopera.com, tricitiesopera.com. William Hobbs spoke with WVIA's Peter Wynn at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton. Thanks, Peter.